Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, we'll be continuing with our exploration of important health issues. And I try to define those issues based upon what generally does not get a lot of attention and certainly not objective and fair coverage in the mainstream media. For example, in the past that has been well organized, properly funded, with a lot of credible scientists coming forward and suggesting that we are at risk of taking vitamins and herbs, that these are unapproved, that they should be under FDA scrutiny, and that we run the risk of killing ourselves, injuring ourselves. And they'll use some worst-case scenario, taking some isolated story and making it seem as if this is more common than not. However, what is not shown is the actual statistics. Let me share actual statistics from the Senate Labor Committee, testimony given that included the Association of Poison Control Centers and the Center for Disease Control, the Journal of the American Medical Association, the FDA's own reports, and annual average death comparisons. Here is the chart. The adverse drug reactions given appropriately and properly by doctors that still cause their patients to die because of an adverse reaction the person had to a properly prescribed. Mind you, when I say proper, I am suggesting that many such drugs are not properly given, and those are another set of statistics where they're using an experimental drug or quite simply the doctor's giving the wrong drug for a condition. Those figures are far higher in death than 140,000, but we're only dealing now with properly given drugs, given by the best hospitals, the best doctors. They kill 140,000 people per year. We also have heart attacks, automobile accidents, food contamination. Heart attacks killed 75,000 last year, automobile accidents 40,000, food contamination, just bad food, 9,000. Boating accidents, 1,100 people. Birth defects, 500. Pesticide poisonings, 12. All vitamins, 0. All commercial herbs, 0. Now here's what's interesting. At no time in all the scare campaign with articles in all the major magazines, Time magazines, Hack reporters, and all the rest, never once did they cite the actual statistics. Because if you saw, hey, no one died of vitamins, no one died of herbs, but gee whiz, you hotshots, just at your best killed 140,000, at your worst, hundreds of thousands more. And you want to take our right away to use vitamins and minerals that could be saving our lives? That's the other side of the story. I'm going to quote something. This is a report that no one's read. It's from Alfred Russel Wallace. It's a two-part series, and it comes from a international journal that he sends out, and it deals with vaccines. I'll quote it. This is only the first of two parts. This work was published in 1904. It was published as a pamphlet by the National Anti-Vaccine League. And listen to what they were saying. By the way, this is almost 100 years ago that they wrote this. Why doctors are not the best judges of the results of vaccination. One, in the first place, they are interested parties. And in a much greater degree on account of professional training and prestige. Only 3 years after vaccination was first introduced, on the recommendation of the heads of the profession and their expressed conviction that it would give lifelong protection against a terrible disease, Parliament voted Dr. Jenner £10,000 in 1802 and £20,000 more in 1807, besides endowing vaccination with £3,000 a year in 1908. From that time, doctors as a body were committed to its support. It has been taught for nearly a century as an almost infallible remedy for all of our modern schools, and has been, for the most part, accepted by the public and the legislature as if it were a well-established scientific principle, instead of being, as the historian of epidemic diseases, Dr. Crichton, well terms it, quote, a grotesque superstition. Number two, whether vaccination produces good or bad results can only be determined by its effects on a large scale. We must see whether during epidemics at different periods or in different places, smallpox death was diminished as compared with that from other diseases in proportion to the total amount of vaccination. And this can be done only by the statistician using the best materials. In this country, those are our register generals. Two of the greatest medical authorities on vaccination, Sir John Simon and Guy, have declared this to be necessary. The former, in 1857, in a parliamentary report on the history and practice of vaccination, says, quote, from individual cases, the appeal to the masses of national experience. Dr. Guy, in a celebrated paper published by the Royal Statistical Society, says, quote, is vaccination a preventative of smallpox? To this question there can be no answer except such as is couched in the language of figures, unquote. The language of figures is statistics. Hence, statisticians, not doctors, are the only good judges of this question. But the last Royal Commission, consisting wholly of doctors, lawyers, politicians, and country gentlemen, not one trained statistician, hence, as I have demonstrated in my Vaccination a Delusion report, they have made the grossest blunders, and their report is absolutely worthless. What is proved by the best statistical evidence available? Well, the only complete and trustworthy records of mortality, which is death, and the causes of death which we possess are those of the Registry Generals for England, Wales, and Scotland, and Ireland. The former from 1838, the two latter from decades later. But from London, we have reports from a much earlier period, the Bills of Mortality, which, though not completely accurate, are yet considered to show the rise and fall of the death rates from the chief diseases then recognized with sufficient general accuracy to be very valuable. They are continually appealed to in order to show the enormous improvements in the health of London 19th century as compared with 18th century, and this comparison as regards smallpox is one of the stock arguments of the doctors and was strongly urged by the royal commissioners. It is stated over and over again that down to the year 1800, smallpox deaths were excessive, but that from the very introduction of vaccination in 1800, they began to decrease and have been getting less and less ever since. No other disease, it is said, has decreased in the same striking manner. This being the very foundation of the supposed evidence in favor of vaccination, it is necessary to examine it closely, when it will be found to be wholly worthless. And to illustrate in a striking manner the complete ignorance of doctors and also of the royal commissioners of the very elements of statistical inquiry, this requires some little explanation, though it is really a very simple matter, in order to be able to study the effects of any alleged cause of improved health of the community, we must compare the death rates before and after the introduction of the supposed cost of improvements, in this case vaccination, and also compare these with the death rates from other groups of diseases and from other causes. These facts are given by the Register Generals in tables showing the number of deaths each year in each million of the population. Now, smallpox, many fevers, cholera, etc., are what are termed epidemic diseases, which attack large populations at irregular intervals with great severity, while at other times they are far less fatal and more local. Hence, the yearly death rates vary enormously. In 1796, more than 4 million people died of smallpox in London. 4,000 per million, I should say, 4,000 per million died of smallpox in London, while in the next year there were only about 800. In the following year, in 1798, only over 3,000. Again, in 1870, less than 100 per million died of it. While in 1871, there were 300, and in 1872, there were 2,500. Thus, the figures go increasing and decreasing so suddenly and so irregularly that by taking only a few years at one period and a few at another, you can show an increase or a decrease according to what you wish to prove. Hence, it is often ignorantly said that figures can be made to prove anything. But this is quite untrue. They can often be made to show anything, which is quite another matter. But if properly exhibited and compared, they lead to one conclusion only. They show the truth. There are a few simple rules for getting at the truth in such statistics as we may now discuss. One is that we must take as long periods of time as possible. Another is that we must use the largest populations available. Two other conditions are almost equally important. We must compare, when possible, equal periods before and after vaccination was introduced, and we must also compare the increase or diminishment of smallpox with those of other diseases in order to discover whether there is anything exceptional in the decrease of smallpox death, which requires a peculiar cause to explain it. But the ever-varying figures in long columns are so confusing to most people that it's impossible to make anything out of them. And to simplify them, averages have to be taken, showing the deaths every 5 or 10 years and in other ways, so as to find out what the figures really mean, and even then, by altering the periods or beginning at different years, a very different result may often be shown. By far the best way, and that usually adopted by statisticians and mathematicians, is to draw out diagrams by which the whole course of the death from each disease or group of diseases can be seen and compared at a glance. From the various elements tables given in the report of the Royal Commission and from the annual reports of the Register General, I constructed 12 diagrams, each showing the comparative rise or fall of smallpox death and other diseases in various places and under various conditions. And all of these, without exception, demonstrate either the vaccination had no effect whatever, or it tends to increase rather than decrease smallpox death. As many people do not understand these diagrams, I have given a part of one of them in a simplified form in order to render statistical diagrams intelligible to all, and it will serve to show what is the nature of the evidence against vaccination, and also how I prove that the statements made by the doctors and by the Royal Commissioners are not only misleading but absolutely untrue. And then it shows the diagrams. The figure on the bottom and top of the diagram shows the years from 1770 to 1830, while those on the right and left show the numbers of death to each million of population. And then it goes on to explain it. The diagram shows us that smallpox decreased during the 10 years before vaccinations at very nearly the same rate as it did in the 10 years after vaccination. The other zoonotic diseases decreased even more than smallpox during the 10 years after vaccination. General death also decreased after 1800 more rapidly than before 1800, yet the Royal Commissioners declare that there was nothing but vaccination to produce the decrease of smallpox, and that there was no improvement in sanitation in the beginning of the 19th century as compared with the latter part of the 18th century to account for the difference. Now, in an appendix to my Vaccination and Delusion article, I have given an account of a number of improvements affecting health at this very period in time, which are amply sufficient to produce the results shown in the diagram. And I believe it is the most compact and most interesting account of these improvements yet given, the chief of which are that many West End squares and suburbs were built at this very period and were inhabited chiefly by city people, that the streets were more systematically cleaned on a more regular basis and the roads improved, that water supply was much improved, that potatoes, tea, and coffee came into more general use, while the better roads allowed more fresh vegetables, milk, and produce to market, and cemeteries were formed outside of London, and many city graveyards were permanently closed. The results of these five groups of improvement rate in a number of the most fatal diseases. to fully one half in 1801 to 1810 as compared with 1771 to 1780, an amount of improvement which has never occurred in any similar period during the whole of the 270 years for which we have official statistics. And yet the rural commissioners declare that nothing at all happened but vaccination to explain the corresponding, well, I would suggest that feeding people better food, getting more produce, fresh vegetables, greens, grains, and meats and dairy products to market to people inside the cities, cleaning up the water so they were not drinking septic and bacterial-ridden water, and eliminating the process of the massive death yards in the city which were polluting, moving them out into the country, improving the state of the roads so people had better commerce venues, and cleaning the streets of debris, including human excrement, would make an enormous difference upon people's health. Yet, they chose to look in no other direction than vaccines. As you will now understand the method of exhibiting statistics by means of diagrams, I will proceed to state the other more important conclusions to be drawn from our national statistics death rates. Those who wish to study them more fully must obtain the book itself. And then it goes on to list all these different things, and it talks about the interesting thing to note is here that the main drainage of London was completed in 1865, and about 5 years later, the time required for the connection of all the housing drainage, meaning a sewer system. Just let me step aside here for a moment. The decrease from smallpox, quote, since 1871, smallpox has decreased, but only at about the same rate as the other Samoic diseases. Now, what happened in 1871? Now, I'm stepping outside of quoting this person's article. Think for a moment. In 1871, for the first time, London had a general sewer system. At that time, they didn't. People would throw their debris in the streets, and they had street sweeps that would come along and sweep up the debris. Of course, that only gets the larger particles, but feces and urine, and if a person died, they would just put the person out on the curb. And if a person died of some infectious disease, they were infecting outside on the curb, and then people would come along and pick them up and take them to a local morgue, and the morgues were right in the towns. So dead people who suffered from all forms of plague-like diseases would be laying around, and then they would put them in a box and stack them up until there was room to bury them in the city, and then they would dump them in these graves. And unfortunately, many of these graves were flooded, and when you flood a grave with dead, diseased people, the diseased microorganisms get washed everywhere. Quite simply, London was one of the dirtiest, most plague-ridden cities in the world. It had never been designed properly, and there was no proper sanitation. And as a result, people who lived in the city had a difficult time because of the poor roads of getting out of the city and getting to the country. Mind you, the average person was poor. How would you get out into the country to get some fresh produce to begin with? Or even to have a day without pollution, because London was also ringed with many textile mills and steelworks and glass blowing, all of which polluted the air constantly. The water was polluted, the air was polluted, the streets were absolutely toxic and septic. There was no running water in any of the buildings. There was no indoor plumbing. As a result of all this, there was just massive, massive problems with hygiene. Nobody washed anything. If you bought something, you never washed it. You know, if there was dirt on something, you just brushed it off. If you got a piece of meat someplace, it was probably a week to 2 weeks old after being cut and was rancid. And unless you cooked it real thoroughly, the likelihood is that you would end up having diseases. Now, in comes a whole effort to clean it up. And that was in 1871. So they started doing plumbing. They started putting in sewer lines so that indoor plumbing and outdoor sewers and washing all that debris into the Thames and out of the central area. And that's when all these changes occurred. Would gee many. anybody, forget, don't be a statistician, just be an average person with common sense, and you realize that if New York City had no central plumbing and to carry away the waste, the city would have been uninhabitable a few years after it was built. Today, it would not be humanly possible for anyone to live in the city. It'd absolutely be racked with disease. But that's the way London was. Now, what's of interest is these other diseases that people had, measles, fevers, whooping cough, diphtheria, scarlet fever, they had no vaccines at that time, yet they all decreased at the same time and in the same number. And I'll quote now back to the report. It says, in another diagram, I show the death rate from the five groups of cough, diphtheria, scarlatina, which is scarlet fever, measles, and smallpox for the same period of government registration. All of these deaths show a nearly similar decrease in the latter half of the period. Except measles, which shows hardly any diminution, but there is reason to believe that the cause of this is that when vaccinated, children after a short illness die of smallpox. Measles or chickenpox are often given as a cause of death. Now, my third diagram is one of the most instructive and conclusive of my book because it deals with the whole population of England and Wales and the death rates from various groups of diseases, as in the illustrative diagram. In the first 25 years, from 1848 to 1872, there is, on average, hardly any decrease either of general death, of zoonotics, or smallpox since the enormous smallpox death of 1871-72 is distributed over the preceding 10 years will bring it to correspond closely with the other class of death. But from 1873 to 1895, the last 25 years shown, there's a diminishment in all three of the diseases to a considerable amount. For the last 10 years, the diminution of smallpox is the greatest. But this can be proved to be not due to vaccination, as I'll now explain. It is only from the year 1872, after the great epidemic of smallpox, that all vaccinations, private as well as public, have been officially registered, and that a table showing their amounts has been given to the final report of the Royal Commission. From 1872 to 1882, the vaccinations amounted to 95% of all births. Practically all were vaccinated, if we allow for those that died before they could be operated on, or very soon thereafter. But from that date to the number of vaccinations steadily decreased till in 1895, there were only 80% of the births, a downsizing of 15% in 14 years. If vaccination were the chief or only preventative of smallpox, we ought to have a considerable increase in the disease during this period, instead of which it is in this period only that the downsizing of smallpox has been more marked than that of the other somatic diseases. Here, then, we have the first distinct proof that it is vaccination which keeps up the disease, and that when a large number of children escape the blood poisoning lancet, smallpox diminishes. Another and even more conclusive proof is given by Dr. Rutia, M.D. The whole male population of Italy are revaccinated on entering the army. Under the age of 20, men and women are alike as regards vaccination. Afterwards, men have an enormous advantage, if vaccine is of any use. Yet, over 20, many more men than women die of smallpox, while under 20, the mortality rate is equal, again demonstrating that vaccination against smallpox actually does not work and it increases smallpox death. Now, I'll complete that. I give this because I know no one in the audience has ever read this, probably no one in the world right now except for the person who brought us back this report. I think this is extremely important for several reasons. Because here, 100 years ago, 98 years ago, you had a group of individuals, the National Anti-Vaccination League, who were made up of a group of statisticians and mathematicians and physicians and scientists, who took a careful look at all the hoopla around vaccinations and said, you've got it wrong. You have not done your homework. And you cannot, with any strength of evidence, say that vaccination stops smallpox. And yet, historically, if you ask any doctor in the United States, why should I get vaccinated today? Well, because, look, it works. It stops smallpox. No, it didn't. Actually increased it. It's amazing how many times when you dig for the truth and take your time and stay focused upon the issues, that the truth is at odds with what everyone believes. Yet here this report is has been buried for 98 years, but it has the truth in it. And this is something that we should perceive with a different eye today, because look at our vaccine battles we're doing today. I'll be including this on my vaccine white paper page. And also today, in fact, I was going to have him on today, but I did not connect with him. There is an attorney out in California. In fact, he was one of the founders of Ralph Nader's groups, and his name's Turner, Jim Turner. I know Jim. In fact, I got him as one of his most celebrated cases, which he won with Dr. Virginia Livingston Wheeler. And he and an associate are suing the California Medical Society for endangering the health of its citizens for the mercury filling in the teeth. Now, I'm sure he has not read my report on toxic teeth, with this, which is the most definitive report ever done to date on the dangers of mercury toxicity due to amalgam fillings. So I'll be having him on the show very shortly. But look at all the dentists, look at all the physicians, public health officials, and who would believe that absolutely silver fillings are necessary, non-toxic. Turns out not to be true. In fact, most of the things we were taught in the area of public health turns out not to be true. Someone says, well, what's your expertise? Why should you be reporting on this? Well, remember, I'm one of the few Americans who actually has, and it's just a handful of us, who has a PhD in human nutrition, but also public health science. I had to have majors, which themselves are equal to a doctorate, in all these areas. This is something that I'm keenly aware of and keenly interested in, because if we're continuing mistakes from the past based upon built-in biases of deferring to authority figures merely upon the basis of their being an authority figure rather than the facts, we compound our errors. This comes from, this is another report, and this was on the effects of Americans are exposed to 22 times the suggested maximum level of dioxin, says a new study. Quote, the study says levels of dioxin, among the most toxic substances on Earth, remain high in the U.S. food supply, although they have declined in the environment. In food samples from around the country, scientists at the University of Texas School of Public Health at Houston found no decline from test samples taken more than a decade ago. Through food alone, Americans are getting 22 times the maximum dosage of dioxin, according to the EPA's allowable statistics. And it's worse for nursing infants. Among nursing infants, the level was 65 times the recommended dosage. Quote, it means we still have to tighten up and clean up our environment more than it is right now, unquote. Now, why is this important? Because I can remember going into debates for years on trying to get dioxin recognized as being a major contaminant when I was leading the charge to help Paul Rudishan and the Vietnam veterans get medical disability from dioxin exposure from 2,4-5-T. And virtually all of mainstream scientists says dioxin's not that bad. It's not the, you know, the FDA. It's not an issue. Well, it is an issue, and that's an issue that doesn't go away. So we were right. They were wrong, as always. It's not occasionally. It's just that you got to appreciate the irony. They've never been right about anything when it comes to a major public health issue, and yet they continue to have the ear of everyone. This comes from Anna. And she says, I was diagnosed with schizophrenia at the age of 19. I was first given Melaril, Then I was, then I went off cold turkey. I had some adverse side effects and experienced personal trauma and ended up in a hospital on Thorazine. The Melaril effect affected my libido. I became more sexual and did not organize myself well, including my birth control, and got pregnant. In the hospital after my delivery, I was put on Thorazine and prevented from leaving to stop my child's adoption. The Thorazine made me drool, caused me to want to sleep all the time, made it impossible to think past 5 or 6 words at a time without my head hurting. I couldn't perform single things. For instance, I couldn't even bathe. It caused my vision to blur to the point where I was almost blind. I developed neuroleptic malignant syndrome and was packed in ice to take my temperature down and keep me from dying. Many do die. My left side constricted and I could hardly walk, but was forced to go to a dance to work off the medications because the doctor was not available Friday through Sunday, even for emergencies to lower my drug dosage. Even though all that happened, I was threatened with electric shock therapy if I resisted the medications. All this after being told upon admission that I was signing myself in and I could sign myself out after I was treated for my problem. I later learned I was not schizophrenic. I was suffering from malnutrition and stress from trauma. And if I had been given proper nutrition and care, I wouldn't have needed any drugs. I felt violated, wrongly labeled, wrongly incarcerated. I had had a dream before the incarceration would consist of a clear image of the Garden of Eden in which I got an impression that I needed pure water, pure fruit, pure vegetables, and I would be okay. The further impression was that I was not to take the drugs at all. This was in 1967. When I was taken to a general hospital for treatment, I asked for the pure water and food. They thought I was crazy. The nurse tried to give me a hypodermic. I later learned she thought I was on drugs, which I was not. And I ran from her. And the orderlies tried to hold me down so she could give it to me. And I slapped it out of her hand because I knew intuitively that I didn't want that. Arrangements were made for my boyfriend to drive me to a mental hospital not far from there. The way they got me to the hospital was I needed to go to the bathroom, so I said wait, and there would be a place to stop soon. I went in and went to the bathroom. When I came out of it, I was in an enclosed area where I was locked in. I was put in restraints and left there. When he didn't come back for me in time, the police transferred me to a state institution where I endured the horrors above. In my case, I was first diagnosed in the Army, in which I served during the Vietnam War. I had been psychologically harassed by my commanding officer, and I couldn't talk about it to the psychiatrist because it would have caused my unit to be disbanded due to the complications of the situation, and all the men on the unit would have been sent to the Vietnam because they were airborne and infantry, including my boyfriend. So I just cried during my psychiatric sessions and unable to talk about it, knowing that the job of the Army psychiatrist, the captain, was to get to the bottom of my in-service problem. This is what caused me to have a diagnosis of schizophrenia. Instead of asking me if I couldn't talk about it, he assumed something else, I suppose. I did tell him I was having a hard time coping in service and needed a mind tranquilizer to be able to handle the pressure, but I didn't get specific. My friends were in danger. It was too much for me the first time away from home and formally sheltered from such problems. I don't like the term schizophrenia. It means that there is a split from reality. I think what happens is that the truth of reality sets in and is such a shock to the uninitiated that it has a powerful mind-altering effect on a young person, which may be why so many first-time episodes occur in late teens, early 20s. It is my understanding from Gary Nall's recent expose of psychiatric abuses on his WBAI radio show, there is a racial discrimination in psychiatric labeling. There's a long history of how it was first used against the slaves. In New York City, the Child Services is taking the children away from parents who can't manage their sick children. Often the parents are poor, can't afford the medications, or don't want the kids to be on them, and the state takes the kids in order to make it possible for the kids to get the treatment they need, they say. Teenagers and small children in New York City are being tested on amphetamines such as Ritalin and others in order to help the FDA and the National Institute of Mental Health and the pharmaceutical corporations to support the targeting and marketing of legal drugs. I know of cases in which teens have been drugged and their lives destroyed because of the horrendous side effects of the drugs and because of the psychiatric labeling that follows them around all their lives thereafter. It is not a social worker's job to diagnose drugs, but it would be his or her job to refer the client to other services such as psychologists or psychiatrists, and it is the duty to report these people, not a choice. Really do your research before you go in this line of work in your particular state. You don't want to become a tool of the Office of Mental Health or the pharmaceutical industry to help them pathologize kids and parents who should never take these drugs or have people forcing shock on them. Perhaps you might like to look into alternative medicine, nursing homes, or something like that. Write to the Meg Institute or Upstate New York, or look on Gary Noll's website and read the article in his library. It'll change your life. Goes on to talk about some other resources. A couple thoughts on this. This is from... this is a letter to Anna, and I was sent a copy, and I was from MindAid. Some thoughts. Recently, there was a series of efforts culminating in a demonstration in front of the Attorney General's office, preceded by 2 days, where there were hearings before the New York Senate Assembly on Mental Health. Assemblyman Luster was offering up an effort. I've been out of town. I will not be back for several weeks. Cannot participate in any demonstrations coming up, or I would. But I have read the bill. For those of you who are going to challenge and attack him, please do not do that. First, understand there is a political reality to change. He is being opposed by forces behind the scenes. And in all these political processes, we have to start by realizing someone has opened the door. Until that hearing, the Office of Mental Health of the state, one of the more nefarious organizations, purely in the pocket of the pharmaceutical industry, utterly corrupted in its ethic of how electroconvulsive therapy should be given. There was no one willing to hear us at all. I have asked for a complete and total 100% ban on electroconvulsive therapy. That is the goal. I also want to see every single neuroleptic drug removed from the marketplace. They are fit for no one. They are complete and total fraud, as is psychiatry, for that matter, but we can't ban that. Now, between the ideal, banning neuroleptics completely, and electroconvulsive therapy also, and where we stand, we have to be practical, prudent, patient, and disciplined. Work with people, not against them. Otherwise, if people rail against them and saying, this is not the bill we want, it's a sellout, it's a compromise, it doesn't go far enough, doesn't do enough, what do you think a reaction is going to be on a purely human level? On just a human level, the person is going to, in all probability, say, I stuck my neck out for these people. I sat there. I listened to them. I felt compassion for them. What did they think? I could come back here and change all the other members frequently who are beholding the pharmaceutical companies. It's a process. Understand, please understand, it is a process. My God, why do you think I've never joined any of the groups out there? Because you have people who are just out of touch with reality running them. Self-righteous, prickish, chest-beating radicals who get up and say, well, we want it our way or no way, and hey, take that position and see how long it'll be before you can get anything put up on any legislative slate again. Like it or not, we must be diplomatic, we must be conscious, and say, all right, on a scale of 1 to 100, This is about a 5 today. But if we continue to support this effort, and that's what we're doing, I'll give you an idea. Even though I'm out of town and thousands of miles away from the city, and I'm involved in another journey now, I'm still taking time each night to write. And I'm writing a very comprehensive article on the dangers and abuses of psychiatry, with specific emphasis upon institutionalization and electric convulsive therapy. The whole piece is gigantic, so I'm boiling it down to the two that I'd like to see people work on. Then I'm going to see that every single member of the New York State Legislature, every member of the Office of Mental Health, and every psychiatrist in the state of New York gets this mailed to them. And sociologist, psychiatric caseworker, everyone. There'll probably be close to 30,000 people I will mail this article to. That in itself is a major task. But it's one way to go from 5% to 10%. It'll probably take us realistic 5 years before we get the legislation that we can say, this is good, it really makes a difference. Do not alienate people who have taken a step in our direction. Understand the political process and understand the enormous power of psychiatry and the pharmaceutical industry that we are opposing. We are few people with limited resources. They are many with unlimited resources. Try to be smarter than your anger. Try to be smarter than your defiance. Think well before you say something. There is a consequence to your words. Do not shut a door that you didn't open. We open the door. That's also why I work in quiet and secret more often than not, because the very people who I'm trying to help are generally incapable of resolving issues without violence, emotional, intellectual, or spiritual violence. Hard to imagine? Well, let me tell you, be around some of these people, and you could ignite a stick with their anger. And that anger has to be properly placed, or it combusts the very persons that you're trying to get to help you. You can't yell and scream at someone, condemn them, curse them, defile them, and then expect them to turn around and say, okay, God, I'm glad you bashed me and trashed me and harassed me and jumped in my face. And I'm so glad that I could have another dose of that today. It makes me more conscious of how I should support your efforts. Not a way to do it. We're not going to get anywhere that way. So let's try the long, patient way where we continue to do things. I'm working on some documentaries now. When these documentaries are completed, they take the human face, the human voice, the human experience of these crises, and gives it in front of them so they can see these are the victims of their policies. Do they want more of these? That'll come next year. And we have to continue an effort over a period of 5-6 years. Then I believe that something very positive can come from it. But please do not, as I've seen all these emails, I've seen about 50 emails attacking him. Wrong approach. And by the way, the very people who are doing all the attacking, why didn't I see him testifying? Why didn't I see him doing the things? You know, don't just play the victim. Anybody can do that. Have to do something constructive. This comes from 60 Minutes. 2. Dear CBS, as a member of the Michigan Department of Community Health's recipient rights adversary committee, a state watchdog panel that looks into rights and abuses within our mental health system, I was very interested in your coverage of electric shock in last night's 60 Minutes 2. Unfortunately, reporting was extremely biased and misleading. In my opinion, you've done a grave disservice to the public. Why was Dr. Harold Sagem's claim that, quote, permanent memory loss caused by electroconvulsive therapy is extremely rare, unquote, allowed to go unchallenged? Why was Dr. Sagem allowed so much time to make so many statements in favor of electroconvulsive therapy, while Dr. Peter Bregan was allowed so little time to present an opposing view? Well, just as an aside, I called Dr. Bregan to get his side of the... He said they interviewed him. for 8 hours. He was on for less than a minute. But they followed him around for 8 hours, guaranteeing that, you know, they would get more on. Something happened. Back to their letter. This was hardly a balanced presentation. We heard the testimony of a woman who still suffers from the effects of electrical pulse therapy, a treatment that she had received 30 years ago. Yet we did not hear equal testimony from any of the hundreds of electroconvulsive therapy survivors who had been willing to tell their stories about the harmful effects which they've suffered from the new and improved modern electroconvulsive therapy. Why not? Recent studies have shown that patients treated with electroconvulsive therapy for depression suffer very high relapse rates. One study suggested that electroconvulsive therapy alone was practically worthless and that the electroconvulsive therapy needs to be used in conjunction with medications. Other studies have shown again and again that exercise works better than either electroconvulsive therapy or medications for depression. Why did CBS fail to mention any of these studies? I certainly hope that you ask yourself some of these questions. Perhaps CBS ought to do an investigation in the quality of its own reporting. Sincerely, Ben Hansen from Michigan. All right. And let's go to another report. For those of you using commercial cosmetics, pay attention to this. This comes from the Environmental Working Group. Today, they released Beauty Secrets, the first ever consumer alert on beauty products that contain DBP, a chemical coming under growing scientific scrutiny because of high levels found in reproductive age women and possible risk of birth defects. In fact, the scientists' concerns about DBP's risk increased recently after a Center for Disease Control study this fall unexpectedly found DBP in the bodies of every single person they tested, with the highest levels in reproductive age women, the group most at risk. Scientists are concerned that DBP in reproductive age women because the chemical causes severe birth defects. And major loopholes in federal law allows cosmetic manufacturers to put an unlimited amount of industrial chemicals like DBP into personal care products, which require no testing or monitoring for adverse effects. Separately, this comes from the link between fluoride and intelligence, Ivanhoe News Wire Service. Quote, the water we drink that may be helping teeth may be having a negative effect on our children's intelligence and behavior. A new study from researchers at Dartmouth College found the chemicals in fluoridated water may be decreasing our children's cognitive skills. Dr. Roger Masters and colleagues at Dartmouth looked at the blood levels in more than 150,000 children and compared them to the water they drank. They say the chemicals in the water may have an effect on lead levels, which in turn affect thinking skills. Those children who live in areas where chemicals known as salicylfluorides are used were found to be at greatest risk of having high lead levels in their blood, higher than the standards accepted. This increased the body's ability to absorb iron, meaning fluoride, which leads to the negative effects on intelligence, cognitive abilities. Researchers say the results can be permanent and severe. Among the learning problems, symptoms of high lead levels can include ADD/ADH symptoms, violent behavior, and drug use. Silicofluorides, or CIF, are used in more than 90% of the fluoridated water in the United States. One more reason not to drink fluoridated water. I'm working on that report as well and hope when I return from my trip. Actually, I have 3 trips planned, and when I return from the first part of the trip, I'll be doing a white paper report on that on the show. This is entitled The Aspartame Epidemic by Betty Martini from Mindspring.com. I'll quote it. A worldwide epidemic is raging. The cause is a poisonous chemical sweetener, aspartame, marketed as NutraSweet Equal or Spoonful, the most controversial food additive ever approved. In reality, it is a drug which interacts with other drugs and changes brain chemistry. From the paper, Effects of Aspartame on the Brain, Neurologic Effects of Aspartame, Dr. Richard J. Wertman and Timothy Meyer say, quote, compounds that do affect physiological symptoms are classified as drugs by the Food and Drug Administration and are subject to considerably more demanding regulatory procedures than food constituents. However, and perhaps paradoxically, because food additives must be shown to be physiologically inert in order to win initial FDA approval, once they have obtained this approval, they are thereafter exempted from the requirement imposed on all drugs, and their safety continues to be monitored. The companies that manufacture and use them are not obligated to monitor adverse reactions associated with their products, nor to submit to the FDA reports on such adverse reactions. They are also not required to carry out additional government-mandated research programs to affirm the product safety, unquote. So the question is, should aspartame be considered inert? The National Soft Drink Association reported in 1983, quote, aspartame is inherently, markedly, and uniquely unstable in aqueous medium. In a liquid, such as a soft drink, aspartame will degrade as a function of temperature and pH. Higher temperatures and more acidic liquids increase the rate of degradation, unquote. The National Soft Drink Association also knew the use of such an unstable chemical sweetener is illegal and said under Section 402 of the FDC Act 21, U.S.C. 342, quote, a food is adulterated if it contains in whole or part a decomposed substance or if it is otherwise unfit for food, unquote. This report became part of the Congressional Record in 1985. The reason aspartame is so dangerous is that it is a molecule composed of three compounds, and all of which are neurotoxic. All of them. And you have menthol, which is 10%, aspartic acid, which is 40%, and these are neurotoxic, and phenylalanine, which is 50%. Now, aspartic acid and phenylalanine are neurotoxic as isolates, unaccompanied by their amino acids in food to block them or from going directly in the brain. And menthol, or wood alcohol, is a severe metabolic poison. And Sachs Dangerous Properties of Industrial Materials states that menthol is, quote, methanol is, quote, a human poison by ingestion, unquote. It's also classified as a narcotic. Aspartame breaks down to a brain tumor agent, diketopiperazine, and a confidential internal memo at Cereal, the company that developed aspartame, indicated concern over lack of complete toxicological data on this. FDA Commissioner Alexander Schmidt approved aspartame only for dry goods on July 26, 1974. In the following month, consumer attorney James Turner, by the way, that's the same James Turner I talked about earlier today, and Washington University researcher Dr. John Olney filed objections to the FDA's approval, citing evidence of brain lesions and neuroendocrine disorders. In animal studies and concerns that substance may cause brain damage and mental retardation in humans, they also requested a hearing on the safety of aspartame. In December 1975, Turner and Olney waived their right to a public hearing and agreed to a public board of inquiry. On March 24, 1976, the FDA's task force reported, quote, at the heart of the FDA's regulatory process is the ability to rely upon the integrity of the basic safety data submitted by sponsors of regulated products. Our investigation clearly demonstrates that the GD cereal company, we have no basis for such reliance now. Some of our findings suggest an attitude of disregard for FDA's missions of protection of the public health by selectively reporting the results of studies in a manner which allays the concerns of questions of an FDA reviewer, unquote. And then it goes on to talk about Ronald Reagan and how they all got together and interceded and how this all became part of public awareness, or lack of public awareness on this. It says, as aspartame destroyed the central nervous system's patients began being misdiagnosed as having multiple sclerosis. Victims lost memory. Memory loss is number 11 on a secret FDA list of 92 aspartame reactions. Dr. Roberts wrote Defense Against Alzheimer's Disease in 1995, connecting aspartame with this exploding 20th century disease. You know, they're saying it's not really good, shouldn't be using it. And in closing thoughts, here's something to ponder. In the world we live in, frequently people think the world is against them. They have a right to the chip on their shoulder or the merit badge for being a wounded heart on their sleeve. Think well before. If you woke up this morning with more health than illness, you are more blessed than a million who will not survive this week. If you have never experienced the danger of battle, the loneliness of imprisonment, the agony of torture, or the pangs of starvation, you are ahead of 500 million people in the world. If you can attend a church meeting without fear of harassment, arrest, torture, or death, you are more blessed than 3 billion people in the world. If you have food in the refrigerator, clothes on your back, a roof over your head, and a place to sleep, you are richer than 75% of this world. If you have money in the bank, in your wallet, and spare change in your dish someplace, you're among the top 8% of the world's wealthy. If your parents are still alive and married, you are very, very rare, even in the United States and Canada. And if you can read this message, you just received a double blessing in that someone was thinking of you. And furthermore, you are more blessed than over 2 billion people in the world who cannot read at all. Someone once said, "What goes around comes around. Work like you don't need the money. Love like you've never been hurt. Dance like no one's watching. Sing like nobody's listening. Live like it's heaven on earth." Things to think about. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you very much for listening. I look forward to being back tomorrow to share more on health and nutrition. Have a nice day, everyone.